So welcome back to Half Past Capitalism, where we talk about alternatives to capitalism as if they were possible. This show is a part of the Harbinger Media Network and is sponsored by SEAS, which is the Solidarity Economy Incubator for Zero Emissions based in Montreal. Today, we're talking to Yul Herbert, who's one of the founders of Sustainability Solutions Group, a worker cooperative that has been around for about 20 years and has expanded well into the double digits in terms of the number of staff, spanning four countries and two continents. He's also one of my early mentors when it comes to the cooperative world. And he lives on a land trust that he co-founded, which we'll talk a bit about later on in the interview. Welcome, Yul.
Thank you, Drew. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you. So let's start, I guess, with a little précis of Sustainability Solutions Group, the worker cooperative that you co-founded. What kind of work do you do?
SSG basically does community planning, but with the perspective of addressing the climate change crisis. And so our work helps communities, whether they be municipalities, cities, in some cases, larger organizations like states or provinces, plot their pathway through the energy transition and to identify a meaningful response to the climate crisis, both in terms of reducing emissions, but also in terms of adapting to the increasing storms and severe weather events that we're watching play out around the world.
When you do that work, I guess you're creating a lot of different plans for people. You're helping lead processes, stuff like that.
That's right. So we are typically undertaking a planning process that involves both technical modeling. So we build fairly detailed computer models of communities or of organizations and all of the factors or activities within that geographic boundary or organizational activity that influences energy emissions. And then we quantify with a fair degree of detail what impact different actions or measures or policies might have. And we do that in consultation with the community or other interested parties whose future that process really influences in a significant way.
Yeah, so I'm curious, how does your day-to-day life sort of affected by being a worker cooperative in that kind of context? How does that affect your work?
I think having not worked in any other context other than the worker co-op, sometimes I feel like I don't have a lot of perspective on what it's like to work in a more conventional organization. But the reality for me is that I'm relatively autonomous. I have a lot of trusted colleagues. I don't have a boss, nor does anyone within SSG have a boss. And I don't have anyone looking over my shoulder. So it's really about my own motivation, my own desire to do a good job. And I think that's the same for all of my colleagues. We're a virtual organization, so people are operating out of their homes or out of co-working spaces. And we have been since our genesis, almost 20 years ago. And as a result, we have a lot of freedom in terms of how we spend our time. And that includes both in work and out of work. If we need to do something that isn't work-related, we're completely free to do so. So we have a lot of freedom and also a lot of trust. And I feel I can really rely on my colleagues when I need them. And that comes with the fact of, or the structure of being a worker co-op, which means we're all owners of the business together. And I think in general, we all feel an ownership of our future and our collective journey in terms of working together and paying our bills and paying our salaries and having a significant impact on society.
Such an interesting situation to be in, because I mean, I feel like, you know, normally, you know, in a workplace, there's one person who's sort of responsible for the whole thing and who sort of holds that and I guess doesn't have to worry about differing levels of commitment and stuff like that. Like in your sort of 20 years as a worker member, do you find that some people are more committed than others and that creates tensions, or do you find ways to deal with it? Like, how does that play out?
I don't know if some people are more committed than others. Some people are able to demonstrate that commitment in different ways. And some people have more constraints on their personal life and professional life than others. And that plays out in the way they do their work and the way they interact. And I think part of it is really understanding those constraints and accepting it. And sometimes that's challenging. Sometimes it takes longer to understand those constraints than other times, but I think that's really what's going on. I don't know. In our case, our salaries are probably generally a bit lower than what one could receive from a more conventional business. And so there's people made a conscious decision to work in our context for all of the other benefits that come along with the ride. And so I don't think anyone is necessarily less or more committed, but certainly people have constraints and have to work within those constraints. And that can look like different levels of commitment, but you really realize over time that it's about the constraints and the way
that's such
those constraints.
That's such an interesting distinction. What has that been like, I guess, learning how to cooperate? Like what were some of the sort of early, lessons things that you sort of had to sort of figure out as a worker co-op?
I should say, I think we're still figuring out, and we will be figuring out for the next 60 years or 40 years or however long this journey goes. But for example, we've been through a period of growth in the last little while and brought on a lot of new people who didn't necessarily have much experience with cooperatives or worker cooperatives or even flat structures consensus-based approaches. And so we've had to do a lot of work in designing new decision-making processes. We also have a lot of projects underway, probably more than 60 at the moment. And we have to deliver those projects effectively and continue our standard of really being the best in our sector. So all of those are tensions that we have to navigate within this paradigm of not really having any bosses. So we've been spending a lot of work on how do we build organizational decision-making processes? How do we structure ourselves so we can accomplish all of those objectives? And it is really an ongoing learning process. And I don't think we'll ever arrive at a final state. It's just continuously adjusting and evolving and trying new things and really creating a culture where it's safe and low risk to try new things, because that's probably one of the hardest part is that trying new things involves a certain amount of chaos and a certain amount of change. And that can be hard for people to live in that kind of space where things are always shifting a little bit, or in some cases a lot.
And so in navigating these kinds of challenges, I mean, yeah, you talk about onboarding new people with like totally different backgrounds and experiences, stuff like that. Is this something that you have to invent from scratch, or have you been able to sort of rely on tools from the cooperative movement more broadly, or like what does it look like?
I would say in the last while we've really been inventing things from scratch. So right now, for example, our structure is based on what we call the cluster system. We have a cluster moot, which is a coordinating body across a number of other clusters, and each cluster has a focus like business development or project delivery or tools and products or worker satisfaction. So those clusters are responsible for a particular theme, and then they're coordinated by a member or several members join a cluster moot. The moot is a term that came from, I think, Game of Thrones. So as you can see, that process is very much something that you wouldn't find anywhere else, I don't think.
Right.
The cluster system itself was inspired by the way in which the protests at WTO in Seattle, a protest against WTO in Seattle, were organized, which used a cluster system. And that was kind of the idea for that kind of organizational structure. So we're very much drawing on social innovations from outside of the conventional business world.
That's so interesting. And I guess, does that imply that you haven't found anything from the sort of existing cooperative movement that sort of meets your needs in terms of the kind of structure you want to create?
I don't think we've found anything in terms of organizational structure, but certainly many, many other aspects around financial processes or policies or decision-making. So one really interesting method we use for decision-making is that we have this what's called decision-making matrix, which is approved by the membership as a whole. And that basically says who or which entity gets to make which kind of decisions. So it's a matrix of all the types of decisions we might have. It has the different organizational entities, board, members, cluster moot, clusters, individuals. It basically puts a check mark by each decision maker. And then that is approved by the membership as a whole following deliberations. And so that gives us a decision-making framework for the whole organization. And that came from other cooperatives that I think actually La Siembra was the one who introduced us to that kind of approach. And it provides a level of clarity to decision-making, which is invaluable. So there's many sort of ideas and processes that we've adopted from other co-ops that have been very helpful.
Very cool. And what, I guess, what were some of the early challenges? I mean, maybe you can talk about how the co-op got started. What led you to, you know, in your early 20s, want to create a worker co-op in particular?
Yeah. So that takes us back to the 90s, I think, when late 90s, when there was a lot of tumult in the world around social justice and environmental issues. And it was manifesting in these major protests like the WTO protests in Seattle and the FTA protest in Miami and Quebec City, and the emergence of the World Social Forum as a counterpoint to the World Economic Forum. And all of those dynamics were at play. And being someone who was very conscious of the dynamics in the world and seeking to make the world a better place, I and others were drawn into that that process. And through that, we wanted to create models that represented a better world, a world that the world that could be rather than the world that was. And we had been working on with universities, a number of us, to try and increase their focus on environmental and social issues through a sustainability lens. And we realized that we could create a business out of that work, or we thought that we could. And when we were looking at creating the business, we wanted a different model. We didn't want to be a conventional profit-seeking model, because we'd seen the impact of that and analyzed the impact of that through academic and analysis and theoretical analysis, but also seen it in practice in terms of the destruction of the forest, in my case, in British Columbia and others, other locations. And so we began exploring, and I think it was actually my brother who introduced me to the co-op world, which I had no exposure to through school, through nonprofits, really, I didn't understand that world. I think growing up, there had been a co-op grocery store in the town that I grew up in, and a co-op gas station, but I didn't realize that that was a different form of business. And so then I discovered the Antigonish movement, which was a Catholic-led effort to remove basically a feudal economic system in Nova Scotia and the Maritimes in general, in fisheries and forests and mining, in the financial services, and shift it to a co-op model. And it was a really fascinating model. It was very transformational for the local economy of the Maritimes. And yet we knew nothing about it in school. We didn't learn about it in Canadian history. And it really became a global phenomena. There are parallel co-op movements in other geographies around the world, but it really had a significant impact. And so once I learned about that, I followed that thread further and discovered worker co-ops. And so the colleagues or friends who had been working on these sustainability initiatives at university decided to form a worker cooperative. And we discovered the worker co-op movement in Canada, which was small but potent and fascinating in its diversity. And it really helped us structure that co-op. We were very naive. We had no real business. We had no business model. But we did have some really great people, and that launched us on a long, long journey that has ended up here today.
So you were essentially a bunch of basically campus activists on different campuses trying to get their universities to be more sustainable, or like to adopt, you know, world leading sustainability practices in your various milieus. And I guess you met through that process, through the process of trying to do that.
Yeah, there was sort of different networks that formed. One in particular was by Sierra Youth Coalition, which sort of cultivated this effort that was happening on campuses and bridged different parts of Canada. And through those networks, that's how we connected.
Okay. And yeah, can you just talk briefly about some of the other founding members? Like where were they coming from?
So Lindsay Cole was from BC, going to school at University of Victoria. She was developing at the time a sustainability framework for universities, so basically a management system for that addressed all of the different dimensions of operations and curriculum within a university. Geneva Guerin was at Concordia, also working on a sustainability project there and active in the student union. Melissa Garcia Lamarca was studying, I think, geography and environment. And Karen Grecki was at Simon Fraser University studying more economics of environmental systems, but all very motivated, very powerful and very thoughtful characters. We're all doing really interesting stuff now.
And you were at Mount Allison in New Brunswick.
On the East Coast, yeah.
Great. So you had New Brunswick, Montreal, and I guess Vancouver. People getting together and starting a worker co-op. It's fascinating.
Yeah, and we had very much Canada was our playground, as it were, but we really had a global lens on these issues and still do.
So when you started the worker co-op with these people sort of spread across thousands of kilometers, what were the sort of early learnings? Like, what were the things you needed to learn, to make yourselves functional as a worker co-op?
Well, I think we certainly had to be incredibly creative. Our first sort of couple of years just were more discussing and hanging out in a way. We didn't really have any meaningful business. We, with the exception of myself, everyone else had other jobs. And we realized that if I was to go get a job as well, the initiative would likely falter, because we would go off and begin our careers and our lives would take us where they would. So the interesting move was that I think it was Lindsay who proposed that everyone take one third of their salary and pool it in order to pay me for a year so that I could really push the business forward. So that was a pretty interesting move. Everyone was carving out a chunk of their salary, putting
that
it together.
That is a very bold move, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things you can only do when you're young, and probably because of house prices and rental prices and so on, such a move would not even be possible these days.
I was going to say, yeah, that's probably not out of the realm of feasibility for people who are paying like $2,000 a month in rent or something.
Yeah, completely. And in those days, like rent in Montreal, you could get a place for $300 a month or $200 a month, or if you shared it or whatever. And it was, you can really see how affordability of housing destroys initiative by people or creativity by people in that way.
So what did you spend that year doing?
I mean, fiddling around in a way, like trying to set up the elements that I thought were critical to a business, which probably actually didn't really matter. But what really mattered was that Lindsay shifted into a role with a pioneering green building company, the firm that basically started some very pivotal projects in Canada and also started LEED, Leadership in Energy Emissions or Energy and Environment and Development. I can't remember the acronym for LEED now. So they started LEED in Canada. They helped develop standards for Canada, and LEED grew into a major initiative in terms of certifying buildings. And so she was very much at the forefront of that, and she was able to flow little chunks of work to SSG, which allowed us to start building up a portfolio and start understanding what it meant to actually do contracts and how we would actually manage contracts. And so that was really what gave us our start as a business.
And so, yeah, you're saying that sort of where Lindsay was in particular, sort of being in on the ground floor of LEED and obviously having those sort of connections was the most decisive for your success. But what were the things that you thought were important but weren't?
I don't know, writing vision statements and making a web page and probably some of those things which you think are important for communicating you to the public, but really at that stage in your development just aren't that important.
Right.
At least in our case, writing policies or, I mean, there's some nuts and bolts stuff that I did that was probably important, starting to figure out how we might do a payroll and finding an accountant and starting to understand how the RFP world worked which is something that's been critical to us subsequently.
And what is it like being in the RFP world as a co-op?
I mean, in a way, it's no different than being in the RFP world as any other business. You submit an RFP, it's evaluated, and you either win or you lose based on your merits. I think as a co-op, it's been a good thing for us because we're always having to sell the value of our work, and we can't rest on our laurels because RFPs are always competitive. So we've never been able to sort of chill and just do the work. We're always having to be creative, to be on the forefront of our field and demonstrate how we're doing so. And I mean, RFPs are about your track record, your process, and your references. And references are about your past work. So if you don't do a good job in your past work, that hurts you on RFPs. And you need a significant portfolio. It took a while to build that up. We had to be really creative in terms of what kind of projects we took on to build that portfolio. And our members at that time, like Geneva, helped bring us on to do a sustainability assessment of Concordia. So that was one of the first consulting arrangements to do a sustainability assessment of a university. So those kind of moves helped us build our portfolio so that we could be competitive in RFPs. We're also lucky, I think, in that the paradigm in which we're working is a new field. And so we are able to help shape that field. In 2008, the premier of British Columbia at the time was really dedicated to climate action, which isn't something you would associate with his political leaning necessarily. But he really pushed the agenda and created openings for a lot of new firms, new and innovative firms to develop, of which we were one. So the momentum that he created really allowed us to develop as a firm. And in fact, one of the first projects we did was for Salt Spring Island, looking at the relationship between land use and greenhouse gas emissions. And that just opened up a whole new world to us. It was a completely unique project that no one in Canada had really done before. We managed to win it. And the insights from that project we're still using today.
I guess as a cooperative, do you have a sort of competitive advantage? I mean, you talk about sort of being innovative, being competing with all these other firms, you know, who are potentially paying, I guess, their employees more, but have probably more sort of centralized hierarchical standard structures. Is there anything about being a co-op that helps you sort of be competitive?
Yeah, there is. So while we pay some employees less, we also pay some employees more because we have a very flat pay structure. So typically in our competitors' firms, they pay senior people very high amounts, significantly more than us. But they also pay junior people significantly lower than us. And so that has significant cultural implications, I think, which benefit us competitively. Additionally, we don't need to make profits the way some of our competitors do. And that's not always the case because some of our competitors are groups within very, very large firms. And they use those groups as sort of loss leaders to stimulate work for other elements of their business, like their engineering components or so on. But we have outlasted a number of competitors who were small firms who were then bought up by large engineering firms. And then ultimately those divisions were shut down because they weren't profitable enough. So our commitment to the work enables us to outlast some of our competitors. I also think the dedication of our workers and the flat pay structure means we don't have a figurehead or a leader or a boss that sort of becomes essential or core to the organization. We have many people who are very capable, so that also really helps.
Is it fair to say you have a lower burnout rate?
No, we definitely have. I mean, the combination of a deep commitment to impact and very critical work at this time certainly results in burnout.
So one thing I know you've tried to build in from the beginning is sort of, you know, dedication, as you say, dedication to impact, but beyond the sort of contracts that you're doing. So I think at one point that was like putting some percentage of your gross revenues into donating to sort of allied organizations, stuff like that. I know that sort of stopped at a certain point, having been the one-time recipient of one of those donations, or at least one of my organization that I was a part of. But yeah, I guess I'm wondering, And then I guess also you being in a cooperative gives you the ability to allocate time to other sort of movement activities or campaigns or other kind of ways of achieving impact beyond the contract. So I guess I'm just wondering how has that changed over the years, and sort of how do you look back at 20 years of trying to do that as a cooperative?
Yeah. So what you're referring to is, I think for a period of 3 or 4 years, we took 10% of our revenues and basically sent checks randomly to organizations that we thought were doing good work. It was a really neat process, and I think we got really good feedback from that process. It was typically in the increments of like $300 to $500 to $800 or something like that. And we just find a neat group and send them a check. But in latter years, we've had so many dynamics at play. We've had some years that have been profitable, some years that haven't. We've had some cash flow issues. The dynamic is much more significant now that we have a lot more people in a lot more geographies. And so we've been really focused on trying to get our own processes and business functioning smoothly. And that effort continues. So we haven't put as much effort into that kind of donation process. We still continue to volunteer on different projects and support different efforts, both within the co-op sector and beyond. And that's really about the passion of individual members, or something that really aligns with our philosophy that we decide to support.
Can you talk a bit about how the co-op supports people to do that?
I mean, well, we have actually in our hours tracking system, we have co-op volunteerism as an hours tracking category. So you can just go and spend time working with co-ops or helping the co-op sector in some way. Similarly, there's one for volunteering. There's not really any oversight. It's really up to you to make that choice that you want to support some initiative or so there's that freedom to get involved that way. And different people get involved in different ways.
So you must have stats on how many hours people have spent doing that kind of work.
Yeah, and I think I don't know what they are, but we, for a number of years, did a sustainability report where we reported on those kind of numbers, and we're actually working on getting that initiative going again so that we can transparently report on those and many other impacts that we have. But I know in the last couple of years, we've been so overwhelmed with stuff going on that it's probably been a lot lower than previous years.
And you've gone through some pretty big expansions. So you talked about the sort of startup period, but then there seems to have been a pretty sustained growth period, which has you at how many staff now?
Somewhere around 40 plus.
40 plus. Okay. That's a big organization.
Yeah. We actually had a retreat last year outside of Montreal, and everyone from all over the world came together, and I looked around the room at one point and was just like, wow, this is insane. How many people were there? Because we also have associate members and we have like part-time people. So it's like, yeah. It really adds up when you put everyone together.
Can you talk about how that happened?
Well, it happened very organically and without perhaps as much intention as we would like, in hindsight, at least. So we did make a relationship. We did a project in Chile a number of years ago on district energy with the United Nations Environment Program. And through that project, connected with a couple of people in the Ministry of Environment, Ministry of Energy in Chile. And one of them came and did an internship with us through a program that Chile offers in a subsequent year. And when that person went back home, Rodrigo, he decided to create a version of SSG there. And that sort of launched us on this journey in Chile and in Latin America. And now we have a subsidiary and pay taxes in Chile and payroll. And we have, I think, 10 or 11 employees in Chile. And we're able to draw on a lot of insights that we've had in Canada and apply them to Chile. And also, interestingly, some insights from Chile that we're able to apply to Canada. In particular, the Chilean staff were really advanced on adaptation work. And also energy systems modeling. And so we're able to draw on some of those insights and bring them back to Canada. And it's just so neat to have that intercultural, like inter country discourse and discussions and multiple languages at play. And I mean, it adds lots of complications because you're dealing with different contractual issues in different jurisdictions. But it's really dynamic and fascinating.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit more about the process of expansion? Like how did these sort of, I don't know, mergers come about? And how did you end up, like, what were the things that sort of drove the growth? And I guess I'm asking that because a lot of cooperatives, you know, sort of reach a certain size and then they're like, we're good. You know, we've got a stable business model. We're paying our salaries. Like, we don't actually need to grow. Whereas like a capitalist enterprise is like driven to grow. So it's interesting that you've, you know, had this kind of continuous growth. So I'm just trying to get at what's behind it.
Yeah. So it wasn't mergers. We've built up the teams both in US and Canada bit by bit. And we haven't taken on any external investment, which I think is a key part of the story. So we've financed that growth internally. The motivation is really impact. I think we see the work that we can do and see how it can help in other jurisdictions, and be transformative in other jurisdictions. And I think we've really pioneered some novel approaches in the laboratory of Canada, or that Canada is for us, that can be extremely valuable in other contexts. And so we want to bring that approach to other contexts, in the face of a climate crisis. So that's the motivation for the growth. I think the idea that we could become a large worker co-op, AKA Mondragon, Mondragon of the North America context or something, is something that I think is very inspiring for many of us. There's definitely a contingent of SSG members that would be very happy if we didn't grow anymore, because growth it's very complicated in terms of its impact culturally and how you manage yourself and your organizational structure. And it implies a level of change that you have to be comfortable with. So it's not, and growth is complicated in a worker co-ops model. I think it's much more straightforward in a venture capital driven or capitalist model. You just hire more people and that's the way it is. Whereas it's a decision in a worker co-op that has a lot of implications. So far we have gone down the growth road. I think we can continue to grow a lot. I don't know how fast we'll grow because there are cultural barriers or limitations that may restrict us, and possibly financial limitations as well.
But it is, you really feel like it's the impact, the potential for greater impact that has sort of led, you know, the worker members to democratically decide to continue to expand at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two types of impact. There's the impact of the work we do, but there's the impact of our model existing in the way it does, and the story that model tells. So for example, for the first time ever, I did something I would never have anticipated I would end up doing, which was participate in a Canadian trade delegation to Chile this year with the Minister of International Trade and Parliamentary Secretary and other trade commissioners. And so needless to say, we were the only worker cooperative who was part of an international trade delegation for Canada. So bringing that kind of voice and perspective to that kind of fora, I think, is a really different type of impact than the climate action planning work we do day to day. But it's also really valuable.
And in this sector, have you seen any other cooperatives pop up or other sort of initiatives be inspired by, I guess, your example?
Not of late. I mean, certainly there are other cooperatives, like in particular in the insurance sector. Cooperatives in the world still have a huge role in the insurance sector. And so and that's so related to climate that we do see cooperatives and cooperative initiatives pop up somewhat, but really not very much. There are a couple other similar co-ops in some other key jurisdictions, like one in the UK. It actually just folded, which was really unfortunate. And if we were a bit more growth oriented, we probably could have merged or succeeded with that, or brought that co-op into the fold somehow. But we weren't quite ready for that.
I guess to wrap up this section, if you were going to talk to, like, you know, 20-year-old Yule, what would be the sort of most important things that you would convey from your sort of 20 years of experience trying to, you know, build this worker cooperative?
I think the piece that would have been really valuable is business training. And ideally, it would have been business training from the perspective of a cooperative rather than general business training. But actually having serious business understanding and capabilities, like how to read an income statement, how to make an income statement, that would have been very valuable. I should say, luckily, we have found people who have guided us on that process, who have had that experience, but there's not a lot of those people out there.
Has there been any building of capacity over the time that you've been in the co-op movement, you know, to train people in business skills?
No, not that I'm aware of.
So, yeah, I wanted to shift toward, I mean, a whole other topic, which is also could be its whole own interview, but at least I wanted to touch on it. You've been part of a community land trust for the last, I guess, something like 15 years, maybe a bit more. So I'm curious what, so you live on a community land trust. I was going to try and recite some stats about it from memory, but why don't you do that? Tell us a little bit about the community land trust.
Yeah, so its genesis was really similar to the worker co-op. It was a group of friends and I who cycled across Canada in an effort to convince Canadians to take action on climate change in 2001. And we decided we wanted a different structure. We didn't want to buy houses or apartments in suburbia or cities. And so we found 100 acres. We purchased it for $93,000. And then we learned about community land trust model, which is a model that emerged from the US, with influences from India, sort of offshoots of some Gandhian efforts. And then, also from civil rights movement in the US to deal with sharecropping situations, and had been developed as a way to hold land in perpetuity without one or more private owners. So the land is held as a community asset, but people are given long-term leases to a house site or a farm, an area for farming. So they get security and they can build a house and sell the house for the value of that house, but they can't sell the land. So it's a really fascinating structure that treats land like air or water as a common good, but it still meets the human need for security and for a place to live that they can count on. And it addresses the fundamental issue of affordability, which is probably undermining so many key people in society today, because the notion of speculation is gone. You can't speculate on land if you can't own it. So it just destroys that whole paradigm. So it's a really powerful model. We have, we're living on that community land trust. We have a lease, we have a house. There's five other leases, on the community land trust. There's two operating farm operations, both on leased land. And I think it's an important symbol. It's a quiet symbol. It doesn't even have a website. Community land trusts are by structure expansionary. So they do collect excess lease fees, which they use to buy additional land to provide more housing or more farming activity. We have not done that. I think we've just been preoccupied with many other things, but the model exists. It's functioning. We've negotiated with a credit union to provide mortgages on leased land, which was something that had not been done in Nova Scotia before. So we've also worked with lawyers on a pro bono basis, actually, to develop really solid lease agreements. So we've built a lot of sort of the infrastructure, and we've demonstrated that it works.
And so, yeah, you mentioned $93,000. Is that right?
Yeah.
For a house and 80 acres. I mean, it's just 100 inconceivable. Acres. 100 acres. It's inconceivable, in this day and age, to pay that kind of price for that.
Yeah. I mean, for us at that time, we had no money. So what we did is actually shared that purchase price amongst multiple people. So it came down to $8,000 to $15,000 each in order to buy the place. So we basically paid it off right away.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. And I think that, like, making a place to live affordable just enables you to do so many other things, like create a worker co-op, or we've had many different events or experiments that we've undertaken that because we weren't fundamentally financially constrained in the way that many people are today.
Exactly. So yeah, so essentially you bought this land at a time when it was, I mean, by today's standards, just absurdly cheap. And then you sort of took it off the market, but dedicated it to, you know, meeting the needs of the community, the ecology, and the people who live there.
Yeah, I think that's right. And we were inspired. There are other community land trusts in Canada, like Toronto Islands, Ward Island and Toronto Islands is a long-term community land trust. BC Housing has its own community land trust in Vancouver. And so Co-op Housing Federation of BC. So they will build housing co-ops on community land trust owned land. So that means that housing co-op is unlikely to ever be sold because it's on land that cannot be speculated with, which is a risk to many housing co-ops in Canada, is that they just sell them in order to take the land value away.
Yeah. I mean, it's just it's sort of, I guess, tragic to think about how much leverage people had in the 90s, early 2000s, when land seemed expensive, but was actually just like nothing compared to what it would be now. But there was a huge opportunity to take big chunks of land off the market and do something different.
I mean, that opportunity very much exists today. We've had multiple offers of people to donate their land to the Community Land Trust. We've not really been in a position to take that on, but I think there's many people in society who would be willing or open to that possibility, particularly if there is some sort of tax benefit associated in the same way there is for nature trusts. There's also land on which taxes are not paid that municipalities basically expropriate and then sell at auction. That could all be diverted to community land trusts. There's also land that's owned by the public sector, by either municipalities or the federal government or provinces, that could be turned into community land trusts. So there's still a huge opportunity if the intention was put in place to transfer a lot of land out of the speculative market into a long-term affordable housing model.
That's so interesting. So there were people who wanted to pass on their land to a community land trust, but you didn't have the admin capacity to sort of handle that?
Yeah, exactly. Because we would basically have to look after that land and look after issuing leases and so on, and it would just be a job, and we've been overwhelmed in other ways to not been able to take that on. But we've had, I don't know, three or four offers of some significant piece of land over a number of years, and that's without telling anyone or asking anyone.
That's wild. And so what are there other I know in my I don't actually know that much about it, but where I grew up, there's a land trust that seems to be continually expanding, and it has farmland, it has housing, it has all these different things. And it seems to be a pretty big player. And in terms of making farming possible as a business for young people, but a lot of other things as well, because housing costs are obviously through the roof and so on. But yeah, I'm curious, are there any structures that would sort of be able to absorb that kind of land and administer it that way? Or does that not exist in Canada?
I think there are new community land trusts emerging. They've been sort of emerging for a decade or so. I don't know of any that are really taken off as of yet. There is the first community land trust national conference happening this year, I believe. I haven't followed in detail, but I did see a notice about it. So that is an indicator that maybe the affordability crisis is driving some people to think differently. So it would be interesting to check out that conference. And really see where, I know there are other community land trusts, there's community land trust in Calgary, and I think there's other ones that have been formed in different places, but I don't know very many details about them.
And you talked about the different kinds of initiatives that this has been a launch pad for. I was involved in organizing the Free School, many years ago. And that went on for several years. So that was sort of a gathering. Maybe you can talk about that from your perspective, but yeah, I guess, can you outline some of the different kinds of initiatives that have been enabled or hosted by the land trust? And sorry, is it still called Waltegrave?
Waldegrave Farm. The free school was actually lasted for 11 years. And we hosted 3 to 4 day events on the farm where 70 to 120 people would come, and people would teach things that they're passionate about or run workshops on things they're passionate about. And there'd be music and movies in the evenings, and some lectures by some people, with a focus on environment and social justice. And then the farm would provide all of the food, and we would spend a lot of effort on the food. The free school was that the learning and so on was free, and that we did charge a small amount for the food. And then people would camp on one of the fields on the farm. And the idea was actually inspired by, if I remember correctly, an Estonian initiative in Canada that you encountered, Drew. And it was a melting pot of all sorts of fascinating discussions on everything from nanotechnology to Euclidean mathematics to processing roadkill for food to woodworking to bike repair to abstract theories of political science. So there's like really interesting dynamic mix of content that really sort of emphasized the best possible paradigm of adult learning, although there was also programming for children and youth as well. And there's many different initiatives that emerged from that effort. And it was a very inspiring process that took a lot of energy to make happen, which I think is why it ended at 11 years.
And what are some of the initiatives that started out of free school? I'm curious.
I mean, I think different businesses were started, different nonprofits were conceptualized. I learned the other day about a wood barbecue business that was created. Actually, I had no idea about it. Just heard about it 3 days ago, based on the wood barbecuing that someone did at the free school 1 year. So there's all sorts of different projects that came out of it. And it was a very creative effort.
And just to get a little more nitty gritty, I'm actually curious, you know, since you've bought this 100 acres of land and started to farm on it, started with like one farmhouse and a bunch of barns, but now it's like a little village. Like people have built several houses of their own. So how does home ownership work on a land trust?
I mean, you basically get a 1¾ acre lease, and that lease size is determined by septic regulations in the province. Otherwise, it would likely be much smaller. And on that lease, you can build a house and really do whatever else you want, as long as you don't do environmental damage or cause social harm, which are two legal terms. So part of the community land trust is we don't want a lot of rules, because if you have rules, you have to enforce them. And if you enforce rules, you're into conflict. So the idea is really to let people go in the direction they want, of course, within the limit of not building a gravel pit or something more significant like that. And so we do have 1, 2, 3, 4 houses and a new house being constructed right now for an older couple. So this will be the first kind of new leaseholder who's come on board. And they're in the process of building a house at the moment. Interestingly, they're originally from Nebraska. And so once you own your house, you can do what you wish with it. And the point which you want to sell it, you can sell it for the price of the materials of the effort and materials that you put into it, so labor and materials, or the market value, whichever is lower. So the market value of that house, not of the land and the house. And if you put in things like a gold bathtub, you can only sell it for the value of a normal bathtub. So all of that formula is built into the lease agreement. You can also pass on that house to your kids at the end of your 99-year lease or if you decease. So that's also built into the leaseholder agreement.
Okay, so you can pass it on, or you can sell it for the price of the effort and materials, and you don't get to use it as a speculative asset and plan your retirement on, selling your house for 10 times what you bought it for, and then retiring with the proceeds.
Yeah, and I think the idea there is that you haven't had to spend a lot of money aside from the cost of constructing it or buying it whichever the case may be, to get that house. And because of that, your lifetime cost of housing are so much lower that you can save for retirement rather than speculate based on your house value.
Yeah, I mean, it makes total sense. It's just interesting. I think we've just been sort of programmed to think of houses as like these sort of like appreciating assets, as opposed to like a practical way to meet a need, you know, which is to have a roof over one's head.
Yeah.
And how do people feel about that? I guess everyone who's there is committed to that model.
I mean, to be honest, we don't even think about it. Like, it's just your house and you live in it, and you only think about it in conversations like this. So it's really interesting to see. It doesn't change a lot fundamentally.
To pull these two threads together, how do you see the sort of relationship between the land trust and the worker co-op? Obviously, you see the land trust is playing an enabling role, but have there been other sort of synergies, for lack of a better word?
Well, I guess a really fascinating synergy is that we have a new family moving in. The farmhouse, the old farmhouse on the farm, on the land trust, is kept as sort of a building either for rentals or for families. And we have a family moving in right now, one of whom is actually a worker with SSG. So that's really, and that's just completely coincidental. So that's going to be fascinating to see how that plays out just on a practical level. Actually having two people work for SSG is really interesting. But I think there's a deeper connection, which is really more philosophical and economic. And both of these models are illustrations of as the world could be. And I think they provide a lot more public and community benefit than the structures which dominate. And for me, that's why they're really important. They're symbols of something that's different, and I think something that's much better.
Yeah, can you sort of recap the sort of public benefits of, I guess, both of those models, just in a grand summary kind of way?
Well, I think for the community land trust, it's addressing the affordability issue. It's treating land as a public good. So the land trust can enable the public to participate in its governance structure, to walk on trails, even to lease agricultural land. So it becomes much more of a public asset than a private asset. And that, I think, is just shifts the whole dynamic, like you say, of treating housing as a speculative entity and land as a private property, which then implies a certain level of custodianship that isn't implied when you own something. So you're looking after it in a different way. So I think there's many layers that you can peel away to understand the social and cultural and economic implications of community land trust. And similarly with a worker co-op, the primary motivation of worker co-op is not profit. And so when you shift that dynamic in a business, you're thinking about other things like your workers or the way in which you're doing a job or your role in the community. And all of those dynamics happen certainly within typical or standard companies, but they're a much more natural fit in the worker co-op paradigm. And so I think all of that also has social, cultural, and economic impacts that go well beyond just the functioning and day-to-day operations of the worker co-op.
Well said. And I guess my final question is, you dropped sort of a tantalizing hint earlier about creating a sort of a Mondragon of Canada, some kind of like, which I guess sort of implies some kind of mega co-op involving, you know, an educational component, multiple industrial components, and a banking component. You know, obviously that doesn't seem to be in the cards for where SSG is going, but on the other hand, you clearly sort of have some thoughts on that. I'd love to hear more.
So 6 or 7 years ago, 5 or 6 members of SSG were able to go to Mondragon on a learning experience. And we spent 4 or 5 days touring around, meeting worker co-ops, learning how Mondragon functions, as guests of Mondragon. And they actually have their own learning institute in an old restored Basque castle in the hills. And they spent a lot of work developing their own organizational model and actually the theory of their organizational model. And we were introduced to all of that, which was completely fascinating. And I think it opened our eyes to what could be possible in the Canadian context. And so I think when we think about the future, that is the model and the scale and the transformation that is always in the background. And I don't think we have a clear, specific roadmap to get there yet, but it's new to lean away.
Fair enough. And I guess to bring it back down to the more, I guess, the ground, you've spent a lot of these last 20 years actively participating in the Canadian worker co-op movement, but also the co-op movement more broadly. Can you just talk about some of what the movement has accomplished in that time? And also, you know, just sort of where you see it, where it's at this moment.
So I think if I step back and look at the Canadian co-op movement in general, I think it's actually being whittled away. When I was first involved in a significant way, probably 15 years ago, I was elected to Canadian Cooperative Association's board, which was a network of all the English-speaking cooperatives across Canada. And shortly after I left the board, a number of years later, it merged with Co-ops and Mutuals to form Co-ops and Mutuals Canada, which bridged the French-speaking Quebec-based cooperatives and the English-speaking cooperatives into one organization. In that time, we've lost many large, significant cooperatives in Canada, which have demutualized. So notably, several insurance, or at least one major insurance mutual, which is slightly different to co-op, but more or less similar. We've lost three dairy cooperatives in Atlantic Canada, Scottsburn, Farmers, and Northumberland. We've lost Mountain Equipment Co-op. We've had like fragmentation of some key relationships, for example, between Calgary cooperatives and Federated cooperatives. So Calgary being the largest member of Federated cooperatives, Calgary is now procuring its retail products outside of the cooperative movement. Federated cooperative has actually stepped back from Co-ops and Mutuals Canada, which indicates a fragmentation of the movement, or that they didn't see value in the national apex organization. So there's like a lot of those relationships, which were very strong when I started, are more fragmented. And then most notably, we lost Mountain Equipment Co-op as well, which demutualized through a very nefarious process. So that all of those are bad signs to me. And those are, it takes generations in many cases to build up those cooperatives, but it only takes a year or less to lose them. And that's like a huge legacy asset that past generations, current generations have gifted to society. And so to let those go, particularly in the way that some of them have demutualized, is really tragic. So I don't think that there has been any real renaissance of co-ops that I've observed yet in Canadian society. I think in other contexts and other cultures there has been. So I'm still kind of waiting for that to happen. And if you look at a lot of the leaders who are in the co-op movement, a lot of them are the same people who have been around for a while, and they are all amazing people and of all walks of life and all political colors and really a remarkable cast of characters. But I don't see a lot of that fresh new energy emerging yet that is so critical for something to continue well into the future and really define a new vision for itself. So I think that's like the broader context. There is certainly stuff happening and lots of new initiatives and so on, but it doesn't feel like that real momentum has emerged as of yet. The momentum we need.
That's fair. And what do you think would create that momentum?
I mean, one thing we've seen in other jurisdictions is serious federal public policy that is dedicated to stimulating the co-op sector in Canada in a much more significant way.
Okay. And what do you think it would, like, I guess, what would that look like and what would it take to win it?
I mean, I don't know exactly what that would look like. We had this initiative, which actually helped us a number of years ago, called the Co-op Development Initiative. It was like some grant, some loan for to stimulate cooperatives, $40,000 grants. I mean, to scale that up on into a really significant effort to recognize the value that co-ops provide to Canadian society, and to provide serious funding and capacity and expertise behind it, like say some multi-billion dollar initiative to stimulate the co-op sector in Canada. I think that's what it would take to really, really create momentum. And there's lots, like Quebec is the best model. Quebec has done an amazing job to support and cultivate the cooperative sector. So you could just take that and scale it up to the rest of Canada.
Interesting. Well, thanks so much, Jules. Is there anything you'd suggest that people check out?
Yeah, I think diving in as a starting point to the story of the Anangonish movement would be a really, really interesting start for most people.
And where would one start?
Google the Anangonish movement and follow where your nose takes you.
Yul Herbert, thanks so much for coming on Half Past Capitalism.
My pleasure.
Esteban Kelly, thanks so much for coming on and for taking the extra time.
Absolutely, Drew. My pleasure.